Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College Online Journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Make sure not to miss a single podcast and subscribe to A Better Peace, the War Room podcast, at iTunes, Google Play, or your favorite subscription service. The views expressed in this presentation are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of the U.S. Army War College, U.S. Army, or Department of Defense.
Welcome to A Better Peace, the War Room podcast. I'm Ron Granary, professor of history at the Department of National Security and Strategy at the U.S. Army War College and podcast editor of the War Room. It's a pleasure to have you with us. Each year in the first week of June, the U.S. Army War College hosts a four-day National Security Seminar, or NSS. The NSS brings more than 150 invited guests to join resident students to listen to high-level guest speakers and then engage in discussion and exchange on questions of national security, defense policy, and civil-military relations. The guests, drawn from a diverse cross-section of American life from across the country in a variety of professions, are integrated into the existing student seminar structure at the War College, about seven guests for every 15 or so students. Led by seminar faculty, discussions in these seminars allow the guests to see how the War College pursues professional military education, while also introducing War College students to new perspectives from across American society. After a COVID-influenced hiatus, the War College hosted its most recent in-person version of the NSS in June 2022. One of this year's invited guests, incidentally, in my seminar, Seminar 14, was John Roderick, a musician, singer, songwriter, podcaster, and politician. He is the lead singer and guitarist of the rock band The Long Winters, was a touring member of the rock band Harvey Danger, and co-hosts the podcasts Roderick on the Line and Omnibus. John's background made him an ideal candidate to be invited to discuss his experience at the National Security Seminar here on A Better Peace, and we are delighted to have him with us today. Welcome to A Better Peace, John Roderick.
Hello, Ron. Thank you for having me.
So, John, I consciously read the parts of your bio that emphasize the, let's say, the non-Army War College aspects of your life. But what is it that got you to come to the National Security Seminar?
Well, you know, I'm kind of, I'm the consummate civilian, right? I never served. And I also worked in the arts my whole career. So during what would have been my peak military years, I was sitting around in cafes, writing plays no one would ever see, and arguing politics with a bunch of long hairs. So I come from a community of people that don't have very much exposure to the military unless it's through their mm-hmm. parents, mm-hmm. And that's true of me. My dad fought in World War II in the Navy. Okay. But you know, we don't talk about the military from inside. We look at it only as, and generally my community tends to be liberal and
right,
so forth.
Right.
But I've always had a real interest in the U.S. military. And so, in some ways it's a little bit of a secret.
So you don't, it's not something like that
a secret affection.
So in this sense, right, you are literally broadcasting now your interest in this too. So all your friends can listen in and say, man, John, I didn't know that about you.
Well, no, I'm fairly public about it because I'm interested in mm-hmm, world affairs,
sure,
right? And how can you be interested in politics or world affairs without having, I think, a deep interest in sure. the military?
I know this answer, but I'm going to ask it so you can tell everybody else. You have to be invited to come to the NSS. Who invited you to come to the NSS in 2022?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I've been podcasting now for over 10 years, and I was contacted many years ago. I made some comment about the Air Force on mm-hmm. a podcast, and I got an email from someone saying, well, you know, I'd like to just make a minor correction to whatever it was you said about the Air Force. And I wrote him back and said, yeah, okay, thanks, kid. You know, stay in school. And he wrote back and said, well, actually, you know, I'm the chairman of the history department at the Air Force Academy. And I said, you are staying in school then. And then he eventually became the dean of the War College, Ed Kaplan.
Which is,
And so he continues to be he is a listener to my podcasts and a regular correspondent.
Mm-hmm. See, I like this because this is, you know, the multiple things here, right? Is one, the idea about how you met Ed, who before he was dean, was also a colleague of mine in the Department of National Security and Strategy, and is a role model to us all, if he's listening, especially since he's the dean. It's important that he hears me say that. But but that you mentioned that, you know, Ed is an Air Force officer, and he is the retired Air Force colonel who's now also a PhD in history, who's the dean of the War College, to give you an idea about the variety of backgrounds of folks at the Army War College, which can be something of a surprise. And so for you, I mean, the whole idea of the NSS is to let people see what goes on at the Army War College. What did you know or think you knew about the Army War College before you came for NSS Week?
Well, you know, some of the people in my cohort, I mean, I met several of the NSS guests over the course of the week who clearly kind of came to the War College with, if not an agenda, then at least a lot of preconceptions. And they had preconceptions about what they wanted to share with the Army.
Sure.
Right. Either some political beliefs or some sort of, you know, they wanted to be an agent of change. I really kept a very blank slate about it. And I understood, you know, I did a little research and I understood kind of what to expect in a broad sense. But I had no agenda coming in. I wanted to see what happened. I had only the vague sense of it, of what the week would look like. I was surprised at the number of foreign students. I was surprised that at the number of students from other services. It was a much more diverse group of students, first of all, and then, you know, again, I was impressed with the diversity of the attendees.
Sure. I mean, I will say that's even, you know, as another sort of lifelong civilian who's only been at the War College for, this could be going into my fourth year, right? That was something that hit me from the beginning, and that is always, I'm always glad when other people notice it too, right? That we have the,
well, you know, so much so that it was hard, even it's hard to remember it as the Army War College, because although the Army is the main presence, it really feels like like almost a global institution, right? People from all over the world, every allied country.
Right. Yeah, and we are the of the existing senior service colleges, right? We are the biggest in that we have the number of students in our resident cohort. But it is and it includes Army people, but it includes also sister services and 75 to 80 international fellows every year. And so what did you think of the conversations that we had in seminar?
Well, it's interesting. I think one of the most profound for me experiences was, and this is the intent in one way, is to just get the feeling of these Army officers who are at a turning point in their careers, who have proved themselves to be now ready to be promoted to, you know, to a level of real command. And amidst this group, you know, these are the future flag officers of the Army, presumably, right? You're going to get somewhere in this group, there are 4-star generals who are, you know, just coming out of their cocoon. And so just being there with them and getting a sense of what how they talked to one another, what their interests were, and also where they were in their careers. They were very candid about this transition. They were coming out of the War College and all were going to these, you know, widely disparate places to take command. And they were, I think, pretty candid about their anxiety about it, about what a major transition it was for their families, about, you know, their relationship to their, what has been a lifetime of service up to this point. So that was the stuff that really intrigued me. You know, we were talking about politics and about these daily lectures that we received and so forth. I felt like that was maybe the framework to get into these conversations, but it was really hearing and personalizing these people that, you know, you kind of, I think in mainstream society, right, the individual soldier is kind of anonymous until they become a general and a public right. figure. At which point they seem to come up out of nowhere and we read their bio and all of a sudden we know about right. this person. You don't meet a lot of lieutenant colonels and colonels and get a sense of their experience mid-career.
Right. Yeah. And so I thought it was really interesting. You said that, you know, you met folks who came in saying that they were sort of giving an indication there was something they definitely knew they wanted to talk about. And you, you came in without necessarily that direct an agenda. But I'm trying to remember, I remember some of the conversations we had in seminar, and there were times, you know, people clearly had things they knew they wanted to get into the conversation. In the discussions among the guests over the course of the 4 days, did you notice any changes in what people, either in yourself or in other people, and sort of, this is what I expected, this is what I'm experiencing, and that contrast is either, is it good, bad? Is it, you know, eye opening?
I think we all have a sense in civilian life that the Army tries not to engage in politics overtly, right? And there's a reticence on the part of the officers to express, you know, a vocal political opinion. Although within seminar, that's not true, right? You get a sense of who these people are, and they kind of you can see sort of their political tendency. Sure. But over the course of the seminar, I think a lot of my fellow attendees started to realize the Army itself has a relationship to American politics that maybe we wouldn't expect. Mm-hmm. You know, in the last several decades, maybe since Vietnam, the Army has been sort of embraced by conservative politics and maybe in a way fetishized. And then liberal politics has increasingly distanced itself from the armed right. services. And it wasn't always so, right? In the mid-century and prior, there were just as many liberal hawks as there were, you know, and there were a lot of conservatives that were doubtful about American military power. And I think that's an artificial divide. I think there are lots of Democrats and liberals and internationalists who believe in American right. power and who recognize its role. And being, I think, there with people who both were suspicious of Army politics because they were coming in mm-hmm. as liberals mm-hmm. or were a little too aggressive about Army politics because they thought we should, you know, because they had a flag on their hat. And the experience of being in that room, I think over time tempered that on both sides, except in maybe one or two occasions where somebody just had too much to say.
Which does certainly happen. But it is, you know, the idea that if the Army is to both emerge from and reflect the society that it defends, right, there should be as much diversity of thought in the Army as there is in society. At the same time, though, we talk about this a lot. We talked about it in seminar, right? In an all-volunteer force, the military, the Army will be drawn from certain segments of the population and not other segments. And to think about, you know, what happens over time, right, to use a scientific term that the Army's fond of, is the delta between the sort of the center of the Army and the center of society in general. If that spread gets too big, then they can't communicate with each other anymore. And if the idea of by bringing you all in to talk about things gives a chance for everybody to see where there are still points of contact, and to look for ways that we can sort of pull ourselves back towards each other, right? Not to say that we all have to agree on things, but that that we are what the disagreements that we have are within a larger, you know, to use old fashioned terminology, within a larger sort of American consensus, and we figure out sort of what that consensus is.
What I started to think about while I was there is the if you will, the kind of intellectual property of the United mm-hmm. States, the Constitution, the history of the U.S., the flag. I mean, the idea of the ideas of the United States, the Supreme Court holding the Congress in check, the you know, the balance mm-hmm. of power in a democracy, and really American democracy. And this is a kind of intellectual property that the left and the right in this country fight over ownership mm-hmm. of these ideas. And I think both sides of the political spectrum believe that they have the right idea about what that intellectual property constitutes. And the other side is misunderstands, mm-hmm. right. I guess, what those things are. What I was so impressed with was that the Army embodies a lot of those ideas. And more than anything, I think I heard the word democracy more in the week that I was at the Army War College than at any time in the previous 2 years. It keeps coming back mm-hmm. to that. Mm-hmm. And it worries me that there is in our culture now a tendency to disrespect, even denigrate some of those American institutions because on the left, you know, there's a consensus now, or not a consensus, but a trend to think that, oh, America is a racist country and all of our founders were, you know, and so therefore these documents are mm-hmm. invalid. Mm-hmm. And on the right, there's a, you know, there's a, I think, a real tendency to misunderstand who the founders were and what their intentions were and what our history right. is.
So we should be able, and one would think, in a healthy society, in a healthy relationship, in a healthy life, right? We should be able to recognize our, I won't even say our shortcomings, but say we should be able to recognize our flaws. We should be able to understand that there is something to be gained from feeling good about overcoming those flaws, without feeling like we have to, that we can only talk about the good things. This is what I struggle with this. And I think about this in our conversations. Democracy should be about disagreement. Democracy should be about, you know, if a republic is to survive, there have to be a variety of opinions that are, you know, testing each other, right? When we talk about this in practical terms in the military, you talk about, you know, iron sharpens iron, right? If you have different ideas, that they make all the ideas better. But the toughest one is figuring out is what do you do with the, you know, how can you have heroes who are overcoming problems if you don't recognize that the problems exist? Right. You know, can you celebrate Martin Luther King without recognizing that there had been Jim Crow and segregation? Can you celebrate Abraham Lincoln without recognizing there was slavery? Right.
We had an incredible exchange, and it was a little bit in the room, but also as a sidebar. You know, one of the attendees in the group was a woman from Atlanta who was a politician and clearly versed in you know, contemporary Black politics. And then sitting between us was a Black officer, also from yeah. the South. And somehow the 1619 Project mm-hmm. came up in conversation. And there was a little bit, you know, there was a tussle about it because one of the attendees felt like blah, 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 critical race theory, blah, 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 blah. And it went back mm-hmm. and forth. And the officer sitting next to me leaned over and said, you know, honestly, I have no idea what the 1619 Project says. And I really feel like that's a gulf mm-hmm. or, you know, that's a gap in my education. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I was just so impressed by the fact, well, I was struck by the fact that, yeah, he's a career officer in his mid-40s. That was not what was in his school right. in whatever, Georgia.
Yeah, back in the 1980s or whenever, 1970s yeah. when he was in school, right? Yeah.
And, you know, he would have to seek it out to understand it. And there wouldn't be, or to not understand it, but to even be familiar with right. with the idea. And, you know, and I thought kind of interesting. And also I was excited to be in a position to say like, yeah, this is really something you should read about. It's not, I don't think that stuff is controversial. Mm-hmm. I think it's, what are we doing here? Like we all have to be open to reading all of this material and reconcile ourselves right. to it. And so then he and the woman from Georgia started a conversation about it. And I hoped that that it sparked right. something in him.
Yeah.
I
go ahead, John. No, you
go ahead. I was struck also by the fact that the Army was speaking to itself and saying, we have a recruitment problem. We have an issue, which is we don't want to lower our standards. If anything, we would like to keep them as high as possible. But we don't have – what that does is eliminate a lot of the potential recruits. And also, it is an all-volunteer Army. And we do feel that gradually we're becoming in a more polemical society, in a polarized society, we're only drawing from one mm-hmm. side mm-hmm. of the political spectrum. And boy, that struck me. How does the Army make itself relevant, attractive, compelling to the mm-hmm. left in this country? And I don't mean the mm-hmm. radical left. I mean, you know, I mean moderate and liberal mm-hmm. people. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's a natural fit.
Concepts of national service, concepts of being a part of the community, right?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, in the last 15 years, not even that, 10, we've watched the nerds take over the culture,
mm-hmm. right?
Right. The software nerds, the comic book nerds, it's nerds all the way down. And what people don't realize is that Army officers are the consummate nerds. It's the original, you know, it's the original place for nerds to congregate. It's engineers, people concerned with logistics, people concerned with like crazy machines that, you know, that with laser beams and so forth. Everyone you meet, they're not like muscle bound, quote unquote warriors mm-hmm. as much as they are just core, you know, core nerds. And so there's a lot of overlap. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that's the idea that many of the challenges that Army officers face, or the tasks that they have to do, are technical, are practical, are for want of a better word, are objective. Right? There's no Democratic or Republican way. Like they say, there's no Democratic or Republican way to fill a pothole. There's no Democratic or Republican way to organize a campaign. Right? Or if you're the Corps of Engineers, right, to build a bridge, and that this should be about people recognizing or sort of embracing an ethic of service. Putting their skills to work for the greater good, right? We see these people who have devoted their lives to it by the time they come to the War College. And, you know, this is an honorable thing for people to do. And it is not, you know, there is no ideological litmus test for being a good and successful Army officer. There shouldn't be.
Right. And I think the issue on the left is if you mm-hmm. don't believe that the United States Constitution was written in earnest. You know, if you don't believe the first 150 years of the United States was done was a continuation of the Enlightenment and furthered the cause of human progress, then a concept of service is mm-hmm. lost. Mm-hmm. And that is a problem in American politics that the Army War College can't really address.
But. I'm afraid. I mean, that of course is the challenge, right? Because we're getting them, you know, after they've been in the service for 20 years. So the question is that you know, people who are joining up today under today's circumstances, right? You know, probably by the time they get to the War College, if they get there, I might still be there. Who knows? That depends on the War College, I guess. But the idea about what people will end up doing. I think about that because we talk about pipelines and trends, right? So when did people come in? And one wonders what will be different about the service. You know, when you or I, so you and I were born about a year apart. So we both, when we were in our 20s, the world, you know, was the Cold War, yes, but the United States was not actively fighting multiple wars around the world. And so people who joined the service after 1973, after the end of the Vietnam War, but before the first Gulf War in 1990, that people who served in that sort of two-decade block served in a period of relative peace, so preparing for war, but relative peace. People who've served in the Army since the mid-90s to the present have served in armed forces that have experienced almost constant war, which might in some cases might have encouraged some people to decide to join, but also might have dissuaded other people from joining. And now we may be entering, are we entering a new period of, as we leave Afghanistan, as we leave Iraq, where we're not actively engaged in full-scale war? Will that change? Or how long, goodness knows, we don't even know how long the period of peace will last, but are we entering a new period where people will be able to consider the question of joining the armed forces as a matter of national service without feeling like if I join the service, that means I'm going to Afghanistan, I'm going to Iraq? And what that will do is an interesting question. Go ahead, John.
I think the war in Ukraine, going into the War College this spring, the war in Ukraine was a couple of months old, and I was really excited to hear like how everybody was digesting it. And I think it was maybe a little too early. What the conversation that did touch on Ukraine was about was kind of like, well, technologically, this is saying interesting things about armor, about
logistics,
about big weapon systems, logistics. Right, logistics was the whole story those first couple of weeks, and the guy in our seminar that was from artillery was real smug about artillery. All of a sudden, it was a lot harder to to be an Air Force jock and be talking about how the F-22 is dominating the skies. But I do think Ukraine has very quickly kind of changed the dynamic around war. Because the Russians are such a clear global adversary and are so undemocratic. And we have the good fortune to have a president right now who's practicing that kind of old school diplomatic global sense of, using U.S. power in service of a greater good.
Right.
And so there's, there's widespread support for Ukraine and understanding that this is a military conflict, ultimately an army conflict. And watching the United States make a huge difference on the battlefield, just in terms of logistics and supply. So I agree with you, 5 years from now, there may be a new cohort of people joining with at least this sense of altruistic consideration. Like, am I part of a bigger thing? Is America really kind of the hero here, or at least a hero here?
And I guess that's what we will continue to wrestle with, right? As we talk about, recognizing the hero's flaws, recognizing the challenges, but encouraging people to serve nonetheless. And creating these kinds of conversations so that people can see what it's like for the people who serve. Because you're right. I mean, the Army, armed forces in general, and the Army is, once people have gone in, right, it's something of a black box for those of us on the outside, right? We don't, outside of the things we might see in movies about basic training or about war, right? The actual lived experience of the military is something that only people who've lived it completely understand. But to try to find opportunities for people from the outside to understand, right? If people come willing to talk and willing to listen, and the Army officers are themselves willing to talk and willing to listen, right? We have a lot to learn from each other to improve those civil-military relations and improve our understanding of the armed forces. So by the time you left, right, did you talk to anybody, any of your fellow guests who said, this is great, I'm going to go home and tell people what I heard here, what I saw here?
Oh, we all did. And it kind of depended on how you came in. Everybody that was invited to the NSS obviously had some kind of constituency wherever they were, right? They're all prominent in some aspect of their field. And so even if they only have 50 people listening to them, those 50 people presumably are also at a level where they're talking to. So it does have the potential to disseminate in that way. And some of the people were very prominent, legislators and other people. And so the effect, I think, was, you know, it was profound on us all. And unfortunately, the NSS happens at a right in the center of a period of real transition for all of the soldiers, yes. because they are about to graduate and go on to the next yes. thing. And so talk about logistics. You know, every day they're sitting in class and they're like, well, I got to move all these boxes to Garmisch-Partenkirchen, and I don't know how to, you know, and my wife is mad. Right. And so, you know, they're a little distracted.
Yeah, that's true.
But in a way that, you know, it makes them less on their guard because they're, you know, their heads are somewhere
right.
else.
That is part of the fun, right? It makes it when you're making up the schedule or when you're the faculty and you know that you're staying, it's perfect sense, right? It's the end of the year. Let's have it just before graduation. But for the people who are graduating, and so they get there, we were in the NSS from Monday to Thursday, then Friday is graduation, and Saturday, many of these people are, you know, jumping into their car and driving away. John and I spoke for much longer during this session, and the staff here at A Better Peace decided to break our discussion into two parts. This first half covered John's experience at the National Security Seminar. Join us next time for part two, where our conversation turns to John's thoughts about podcasting, a subject of no small interest to all of us. For now, thanks to all of you for listening in. Please send us your comments on this program and on all the programs, and send us your suggestions for future programs. We're always interested in hearing from you. We look forward to welcoming you to our next conversation. And until next time, from the War Room, I'm Ron Granary.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.